Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is June 10th, 2026, and this is episode 612. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York, the greater Rochester area. And you're listening to Radio War Nerd. Make sure you support the show, subscribe, go to patreon.com/RadioWarNerd and support the show, subscribe. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, still in the boot heel of Italy, but not for super long. John, how you doing?
Oh, I'm okay. Yeah, not for long, unfortunately, because we got a delivery of a dozen empty cardboard boxes today, and we're going to make the big hegira to New Zealand, but that is such a wretched trip.
Yeah. I know how much you love traveling, especially by air, airport to your sailing book should be from airport to airport, castle to castle.
Yep. And I'm one of those people that sedatives don't work very well on, so I tend to have a little anxiety attack every 5 seconds or so. Oh, but hey, I've found a news story for you. There's a new variant of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, a tick-borne disease.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Well, is this the one that that basically gives you an allergy to red meat, among other things?
No, but it causes gangrene.
Oh, wonderful.
Green meat.
At any rate. I see. So good for the flies, bad for the two-legged mammals.
I guess.
Yeah. Oh, dear. You know, I feel like maybe we should relaunch our old exile, the Schopenhauer Awards. I mean, the screw worm has become a big deal out here. And it is so Schopenhauerian. It's just there to cause pain and misery to cows, which already have a pretty awful life as it is. And it made its way across the border, and it's in the U.S. because Doge or something decided that funding science into the screw worm was woke or something.
Yeah. So the number of things they consider woke is exhausting.
Right. So I don't know. In a weird way, maybe this has to do with woke or definitely anti-woke in a big way. Today, we are very happy to have with us author Devin Thomas O'Shea to talk about his great read of a new book, The Veiled Prophet, Secret Societies, White Supremacy, and the Struggle for St. Louis. It's coming out through Haymarket Press. It's coming out on June 23rd, so you can pre-order it, and you will hear why you're going to want pre-order when we talk to him. So first of all, Devin, thanks for coming on Radio War Nerd.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge, huge Radio War Nerd head,
cool.
Especially the Civil War episodes. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the echoes of Nathaniel Lyon and the episode at the campground. What was it?
Camp Jackson, named after Clybourne Jackson, I believe.
He was the champion retreater, among other things. I think he visited every city in Missouri as he tried to move ahead of the pursuit.
Yeah, the episode you guys did on the German 48ers also, that was a seminal.
With Matt
Chrisman. Yeah, that was, oh my God, that was so important to me.
Yeah, I noticed you write a lot about the German influence. It's really fascinating, both in the Civil War but also in Reconstruction as a real force for, you know, progressive organizing in labor and in politics.
Yeah, they're just it's sort of forgotten, as you guys remarked upon, because of the two world wars and then the Red Scare. That's sort of a triple threat of making an entire population of people disappear from the historical record.
Yeah.
But they did change the DNA, both of St. Louis and Milwaukee and Chicago, all these Midwestern places they ended up.
right.
in a really fascinating way.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, your book is divided into three parts. And the first part is, as you said, I mean, it's really, it's very Radio Warner. It's, I mean, it really covers sort of the pre-Civil War era. I mean, we're talking about Missouri here. We're talking, this is a book that's kind of like an alternative biography of St. Louis, which is what makes it so fascinating. And Missouri, of course, as we've covered on Radio Warner in John's Civil War episodes, this was, you know, what they call one of the border states. And it was a nasty, the Civil War was particularly nasty there. And as it crossed over into Kansas before the outbreak of the full-scale Civil War, as the, you know, parlance of our times goes. But part one, it really covers pre-Civil War, and then Reconstruction era. And it's really rich. And this is, of course, the era out of which this Veiled Prophet sort of society comes out of. But I guess before we get to all of that, first of all, can you briefly describe for us what we're going to be talking about today and the subject of your book?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. The main access point, I feel like, for most people is Ellie Kemper, the actress from The Office.
Yes.
This is the Veiled Prophet Society in St. Louis, and they are a secret club that's been around since 1878. And Ellie Kemper got in a whole lot of trouble because every year they put on a debutante ball and they crown a queen of love and beauty. And in 1999, Ellie Kemper was crowned queen because she's the daughter of the Commerce Bank fortune. Mm-hmm. And she got to sit next to the Veiled Prophet, who is a Klansman character with like a hat with some Hermes wings on it, a gold sort of visor's hat, and then a big veil covering his identity completely. And she gets to serve as his 19-year-old queen. He's usually like the father of her dad in some capacity. But as Mark was explaining, this all goes back to basically bleeding Kansas. Like,
right.
It kind of goes back all the way to an ex-Confederate cavalry officer who founded the society named Alonzo Slayback.
Yeah, yeah, we have to. I mean, I want to emphasize that again. I mean, the first and kind of overriding main characters of this book, and it's such a perfect name. Like, this is the kind of name that Charles Portis, yeah, or Portis or Mark Twain would come up with. Slayback, yeah, you know, the Slayback brothers. And it really fits with them. And it's an incredible story. The story of Alonzo Slayback. I mean, you know, quite an active fellow. And it met kind of an interesting end. But could you talk a little bit about the Slayback brothers and, you know, because it's like through these biographies, whether it's the biographies that you tell of some of these characters or also the thread of the Veiled Prophet, it's like a history of a part of the United States or a part of the world in a sense, but you really, through their trajectories, you kind of get somewhat familiar history from a very particular level, and it's really fascinating in that way. But yeah, describe who the Slayback brothers are.
Yeah, this is the history of the periphery that like happens to, I think, tell a really good story about America and this particular era. I think in your Civil War episodes too, that you convey the sort of like opportunism of the West and bleeding Kansas, especially where, you know, tons of pro-slavery forces are moving to Missouri in an attempt to basically do what Israel is doing, to like settle open land in favor of like gaining more ground politically. And then you have the counter forces settling in Kansas, the abolitionists and free soilers.
Right, yeah, whole trainloads of them with free tickets going to Kansas.
Yeah, trying their best to establish as quickly as possible a government that can outlaw slavery as fast as possible. And then, like, there's all these like little towns on the border in Kansas. One's called Atchison, which is named after David Rice Atchison, the pro-slavery governor of Missouri, who personally fired a cannon at Lawrence in Bleeding Kansas.
Yeah.
Sort of a ceremonial cannon firing, but to get to Alonzo and his brother Charles, Alonzo is born in up in Plum Grove, Missouri, which is north of St. Louis, pretty close to like mid-Illinois. And then he goes to Lexington to a Masonic college to be educated because his dad was a big Freemason. And then that kind of puts him, as he's studying law and trying to become a lawyer, in St. Joseph, Missouri, a little bit north of Kansas City.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to stop you real quickly. What does it mean to be a Masonic university, and how would that influence? Yeah,
That was like a fascinating detail because this didn't happen super frequently, but the Freemasons in Missouri, I guess, were dying at such a rapid clip that they established a college fund for orphaned children of Freemasons. And so his dad, I believe, died of cholera.
Right.
And when he was very, very young, and he just happened to be like, well, we just opened a Masonic college in Lexington for him to go to, which is not close. It's like all the way across the state.
Right.
If I could have a little digression, cholera was so effectual as an agent of death across the Mississippi Valley that although nobody understood it very well, there were lots of attempts to introduce it to the northern states, and even the most northerly states. A doctor who later became governor or senator, I think, tried very, very hard in his earnest way to introduce cholera through infected clothing.
There's a very famous, of course, there's the Chicago fire, but there's also the St. Louis fire that, like, it was in the middle of the cholera epidemic, and it burned so hot and spread so fast, partially because they were trying to cleanse the air of cholera by having giant bonfires at major street intersections. There's this whole, I swear to God, it's like a cartoon of like the doctors at first were like, you got to only eat meat and that will also help you against cholera. And then a bunch of people got sick and they were like, never mind, switch to vegetarianism and then inhale the fumes from the intersection bonfires. But the Great Fire is also credited with getting rid of cholera in the 1849 in St. Louis because it just evaporated all of the water, the stagnant water out of the city.
Right.
Wow, that hot. That's crazy. Yeah.
It's true Looney Tunes sort of medicine.
Yeah, if they hadn't clung so hard to their low-level civic interference model, they might have sunk a few wells, and that would have cleared things up nicely.
Yeah, it's like the apparently the it was just a total mess. It took like decades for St. Louis to clean up most of the like the ponds that they named after the city founders turned into cesspools and a whole thing. Henry Bornstein, who is one of the big socialists in town, a German 48er, or kind of missed the mark, but was a friend of Marx. He said he dodged cholera because he took ice baths every morning. So
interesting.
But cool.
So, before you go on, just for listeners to understand Missouri and how, and you talk about this in your book, and St. Louis is kind of almost like this, well, back then it would have been kind of the western edge of America, but today it's definitely the center. I mean, it wasn't formally the western edge in 1860, but it was largely considered that because the West hadn't really been settled much yet. But Missouri is, it borders eight states. Actually, it's funny. I just went over this with my older son like 2 days ago when he asked me about it. We were looking at maps. He's a map fan. Every good budding war nerd is a map fan.
Every right-thinking person is a map fan.
And just for, you know, so you can picture it if you can. So on the southern border of Missouri is Arkansas, and we recently talked about Arkansas a lot and Charles Portis and the Red River Campaign because south of Arkansas is Louisiana. Then kind of southeast is Tennessee and Kentucky, and then straight east is Illinois. And it goes, I have to admit, I sometimes would forget this. I mean, Missouri goes pretty high up. Illinois is like a pretty long state, and Missouri goes way up in what you would normally consider to be the north. Then north of Missouri is Iowa. Then it touches a little bit of Nebraska on the west, and Kansas is the main one, especially for our purposes here. It's borders has a long border with Kansas to the west, and then a bit of a border with Oklahoma. So it's pretty much smack dab in the middle. And on the eastern side, where the Mississippi is, that's St. Louis. And on the western side, it has Kansas City, which runs into both states. So that's just situated a little bit. It's got a lot of different relevances. And then St. Louis was the boom town, of Missouri. Or it would become that anyway. Yeah. To get back to your story here, because we're going to go off on digressions. There's just no way not
to. We'll do it. Yeah. And apologies in advance.
Yes, yes. So getting back to the Slayback Brothers.
I think that's the best part.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like you're saying, that is funny because when Slayback, after the war, tries to explain why he joined the Southern Confederacy after being born in Marion County, which is almost halfway up Illinois, he's like, well, I loved the South and I loved my people. And it's like, that makes the South pretty high-waisted if you're all the way up there.
High-waisted, that's good, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, Jim has a subplot in Huckleberry Finn where he actually somehow misses the Illinois shore in a fog, is a little doubtful because it's pretty long shoreline.
Pretty long. It's not the same as being out to sea. Yeah, that is that's a little mythological, little touch.
Right.
But this,
I think he's aiming for Cairo. Like Cairo is the only town, and you know that's cutting it pretty close because it's the southerly point, I would think, of Illinois.
Yeah, Cairo's right down there, and like it is. That's a beautiful spot. Also, if you're ever trying to get a big view of big rivers coming together.
Right.
You're from St. Louis, is that right? I mean, you were born and raised there?
Yep, born and raised, still there, still kicking around.
Okay, all right. Sorry for keeping interrupting you. Let's get back to the Slayback Brothers. And then also I want to get back to your own history there, but yeah.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, like Alonzo, I think it's important to, like St. Joseph becomes like a raiding town for Bleeding Kansas, and Alonzo is a big wheel and just like stashing supplies away for the what has not been named yet but will become the Confederacy. I actually have to think about this quite a lot because the way that Missouri works is that Kansas City and St. Louis have always been blue and progressive and contributed most of the GDP and is where most of the people in the state live. And yet it has always been entirely dominated since the pre-Civil War era by a psychotic cabal of Republican, regressive, pro-slavery, state house thugs, including the governor. And so it's always confusing in Civil War history, I think, to look at Missouri, and it's like always kind of partially shaded. Was it a slave state? Was it not? Did it join the Union? But like you say, St. Louis is like the thing that mattered strategically, as you've covered also the arsenal in downtown St. Louis, biggest cachet of weapons west of the Mississippi. And the state leadership, of course, loved Claiborne Jackson, and they seceded and joined the Confederacy, but that didn't matter because all the guns were in St. Louis and all the political power was there, too.
And really, the only federal officer, well, one of the few at any rate, who wasn't sleepwalking through this interregnum was their one leader who mattered. And Lyon, L-Y-O-N, just went in there and took the arsenal. He was one That's of right. those federal officers who are smeared as hot-headed by Confederate historians. There's some imaginary story about he hit a private because he was so hot-headed, very widely spread in Confederate histories. I haven't found anything to back it up. But Lyon just wasn't going to deal with it. And he was in on the meetings with this small cabal of people who ran St. Louis, and he just said, no, we're not going to give it to you.
I had not heard that he had a little rumor about, I mean, Lyon was, before this, out in California in the Indian Wars, like up to, you know, absolutely no good. Mm. But
absolutely comes no back, good.
Yeah. Yeah. Exterminating the California
Exterminating.
Indians. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think of him as he's Lincoln's like T-1 Terminator robot.
Right.
He like they order him back east in order to like, okay, make sure this like city does not, and there's a bunch of there's a lot of interesting stuff that happens in the lead up to the fall of Camp Jackson, including that Lyon, like, it's a very unpopular stance even in St. Louis to be like, well, we're definitely staying in the Union. And he has to do a whole lot of like cloak and dagger reconnaissance. John, I don't know if you ever came across the story of how he dressed up as a lady in order to survey Camp Jackson.
I think he was a little guy, and that would probably help him pass. And he was a little guy with a big nose, and I was thinking when I read that, going over to the illustration, he could probably pass for an old lady.
Oh, my God.
Sure.
There's a Life of Brian just suddenly comes to mind. You know? Yeah. Like,
okay. Exactly.
Yeah.
But he, of course, is, you know, aided by the huge population of German 48ers who have a bunch of military experience. My favorite guy of all time, Franz Siegel, who, you know, went to military academy I can't remember exactly where it was. But he's got war experience from the 48 revolutions and is back in St. Louis, him, Henri Bornstein, who was the other? There was another big 48er guy. I forgot his name. Also died of cholera. Just it's operating in the background of all of this. But Lyon basically raises a German militia of the damn. This is still a thing in St. Louis. Also, there's Dutchtown, and then there's the reputation of the scrubby Dutch, and those are all not people from Denmark. Those are people from Germany. Because when someone would say, where are you from? They'd say, Deutschland. And
so that's why it's Dutch town. Okay, I see. Interesting.
Yeah, really pretty insulting.
Yes. I'm sorry, real quickly, just so people know, because this contrast is important between, in the makeup of St. Louis, but the Revolution of 48 in Germany, or, you know, basically the states that would basically make up Germany, you know, in a couple of decades. What was the revolution about primarily?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was about, Siegel was from Baden. It was about, you know, the crack up, as Matt Chrisman, you know, beautifully put it. It's the European crack up of the church and the monarchy are losing grip, and the way... What is going to happen is either the bourgeois will take over or the proletarians. And in 1848, it is like a socialist, communist movement that is attempting to dethrone both the monarchy and the church. And they are doomed, of course. But because of just like the military, I think, superiority of, as you guys know, everything around Baden.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the consequences of that revolt went a lot further than Germany. Like, Polish aristocrats were, well, the ones who were, progressive, many of them reached the United States. Well, because they were facing a noose if a Tsarist army caught up with them. And they contributed a great deal to the power of the intellectual left, as it were. Because, I mean, I don't think a lot of younger people realize how powerful German culture and German language were in the mid-19th century.
Oh, yeah, really up till World War One, probably, or World War Two for sure,
Oh yeah, easily. The impact that, I mean, that revolution had, like, that is the reason why St. Louis did not fall to the Confederacy, is the ramifications of that revolution. And that, like, St. Louis's DNA is permanently changed, as is Milwaukee, Chicago, all these Midwestern states that, like, Hegelian philosophical societies then became like really popular in St. Louis. And like, there's a big public school movement based on the German education system that like built these massive, huge public schools during Reconstruction and a little bit later that we then, you know, neglected and destroyed. But still, nonetheless.
Yeah, and speaking of Polish exiles who influenced things, I mean, a Polish exile influenced the Warner Civil War series because John kind of kicked it off by focusing on Count Adam Grzywalski and kind of the things he was writing and saying. And, you know, so a lot of exiles came over and had this profound influence. It's really been written out in a big way. It's kind of surprising.
Well, I think there was... there were certain regrettable events, although I'm not sure both wars are equally culpable on the German side. I mean, the First War, we can argue about that, but the Second War was definitely a disaster. Yeah. But Grzywalski was one of those German exiles to the U.S. who are in a permanent rage. And it was only after I started to see what he was in a rage about, that I felt more sympathy with him. Like, God, you guys have a point. Why don't they just fucking go organize the armies and bayonet everybody in the legislature south of Mason-Dixon line?
I mean, that's like when we're talking about like Slayback is on the Kansas border, and then St. Louis early in the war is like becomes the first sort of chess pieces to get like secured for the Union. That is like not the popular vibe in the country, you know? That is like, and I think that's because, as we were saying, this is the western edge of the country. Everything west of St. Louis is like the Wild West until you get to California. And even then, not that settled.
Right. I mean, California was seen as a place where they're going to be able to exploit a lot of resources and riches, but not settled. So St. Louis is really...
And you could get there by sailing ship and You didn't have to cross the plains. Like, I don't know if people still see it in their textbooks, but there's a famous popular etching of Columbia slowly rolling westward. It's like, you know, this big woman with a lamp and all that. And she just tries to get over the Nevada part really quickly, which, by the way, is what we used to do in the backseat of the family car. Just get over here quickly. When are we going to Elko?
Oh, you always have to mention the Donner Party at that point, you know.
Trying to skip through that ugly spot. Yeah, there's a Veiled Prophet parade float later on, as the Veiled Prophet parade becomes this very Manifest Destiny themed sort of pageant. And one of the floats famously is a bunch of Native Americans being pushed into the Pacific Ocean by civilization.
Wow.
And it's like,
although to be fair, they had a bunch of Irish people who were supplied with their own pig snout.
Yeah. Did you like that detail?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, maybe we can loop all the way back to that because Slayback, you know, he's in the border war, and then as soon as the Confederacy gets ramped up, he joins and becomes a pretty important cavalry officer for Sterling Price, one of the war nerd's favorite guys also.
Yep. One of my favorite cats.
Hogburns.
Right. So, I guess if you could briefly describe what kind of engagements or where he was active, Alonzo Slayback, in the Civil War, and then we'll have to get to what happens after the Civil War.
Yeah. So, like, famously, the western part of Missouri, everything that's outside of the distance of St. Louis is pro-slavery, mm-hmm. That's where they're recruiting a lot for the Confederate Army. And Siegel and Lyons end up chasing, the Camp Jacksonites and out of Jefferson City, the capital that's on the Missouri River. Lyons shows up with shiploads of guys and it's deserted. And they have to chase all of these guys down into the southwestern sort of corner, which is where Branson, Missouri is. And, they sort of get bogged down in a familiar war nerd theme of it's very hot and nobody's really sure where the guys are, and they sort of get run around the hinterland of Missouri until the Germans.
It's either very hot or in the winter very cold, because that's what they found later at the Battle of Pea Ridge, which was in the same area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just running into the continuous problem of these Union troops are surrounded by, you know, country houses of Confederate sympathizers who don't want to give them any supplies. And Siegel famously is not a very good strategic military mind and is a little full of himself, and that gets them into a lot of trouble. He gets Nathaniel Lyons killed out there in some readings of it. I don't know if that's, John, is that your impression of it?
I mean, the one thing I remember about Lyons' death, I mean, there are a lot of different accounts, but he was wounded twice already. And this might have been, you know, a lot of Confederate troops used one musket ball and one piece of buckshot. So he was wounded once in the face and once in the leg. So he was still ambulatory and he wanted to charge again. And he got hit in the head, and that did for him. That's the story anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Siegel, I think, was supposed to be in a more aggressive / protective position with his troops and just wasn't in the right place.
No, you could count like on that. Siegel to be late if he showed up at all, if it was anybody else's plan. But anyway, he did do a good job because he was trained in infantry stuff.
Yeah, he does get a lot of flack for some strategic mistakes, and there is a ton of, you know, Confederate sympathetic historians who love to talk about how bad Siegel was in the field. But he was also just this monumental figure for the German rallying cause in general.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so Slayback distinguishes himself as also a lunatic, as many cavalry officers are. He is obsessed with chivalry. He is like, has this combination of like diehard Confederate sympathy and a like lust for knights and King Arthur stories. And like, he wants to, he eventually distinguishes himself so much that he gets put in charge of a cavalry division called Slayback's Lancers. But he also falls ill quite often, and his wife has to come halfway across the country to remedy him. And
I wondered about that Lancers thing. Did they actually have lances? Because that wasn't going to work very well.
Right. Yeah, I don't. It can't be right. There's no way that they were like have a musket and a or a saber and a lance and a musket. I don't think so. Yeah. I think it's a callback or it must be some sort of mythopoetic callback.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a good example of what you're talking about because it's something that harks back to at least the tradition of fighting duels or jousts.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make military sense.
But as you point out in your book, you quote Mark Twain about this, that that people like Slayback and the people Slayback would have, the sort of Confederate upper class that Slayback aspired to, they are all afflicted with Sir Walter Scottism or Sir Walter Scottitis. Yeah.
So. Yeah, they had a terrible brainworm of Walter Scott propaganda, which, lots of equivalents today.
Yeah.
Because then the Veiled Prophet Society in the 1920s and 30s will adopt a group of security for the Veiled Prophet called the Bengal Lancers.
Right.
And I think it's both a callback and a reference to a very racist colonialist movie called The Lives of the Bengal Lancers.
Yeah.
of course. But Slayback distinguishes himself in the Confederacy, and then as things fall apart, as it becomes clear that Price and Joe Shelby are all going to have to either, they have to flee or surrender themselves, and they're afraid of being put against the wall, and they decide to exit to Mexico, of course, as you do.
Yeah, you do a really good job of at the particular level, again, demonstrating something that that John especially has talked about a lot on his Civil War series, that the Confederates, first of all, before and going into the war, were the upper class certainly were crazy. And then after the war, when they lost, they expected to be hung. They expected incredible retribution and were more surprised than anybody when no one wanted to hang them. And they should have been hung, as John has, is the title of John's book.
The title of the book. Yeah, exactly.
but, and that anxiety just constantly afflicts them for a long time until it basically is made official. Like they finally realize, wow, they're not going to hang us. Well, we could get back to doing what we do best.
There was an element of, what, are these people stupid?
I mean, yes.
We'd hang us.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Like they thought that because they're like, of course we would hang them. So, yeah.
Yeah, it is. That book is amazing, by the way. It's just such a fun and interesting read. I'm really enamored with it. The cover art also is fantastic.
The cover art is beautiful. I mean, I lucked out on that one.
It's so good. Definitely afraid that they would be treated the way that they would have treated the Union officers. And so they go into Mexico. This is when we have a European monarch, Maximilian, ruling or kind of half ruling over the various competing forces in Mexico that will eventually become the Republic again. But the Confederates are going to Mexico City to meet with Maximilian in order to found a new slave state in Mexico called the
Another
New
Lost
Virginia
Cause.
Colony.
Yeah.
Another
Two
lost
causes, yeah. actually. The cause of Maximilian and the cause of the new Confederate state. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to... I'm not a Mexican history expert by any means, but it is difficult not to see the parallels of, like, this colonialist government is basically inviting a bunch of Confederates in to police state style settle a part of the Empire that they're having a little bit of trouble keeping under control. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of Maximilian's biggest problem is that just Mexico is divided up into a bunch of different competing forces that all really don't want to be ruled by a European guy. Mm-hmm. And so the Confederates then become this kind of police force. And they found the New Virginia colony. Alonzo Slayback also writes a lot of Lost Cause poetry, which
pretty
is
awful,
quite bad.
I have to say. Yeah, it's, you quote
quite
some of
awful.
That and, boy, is it awful! Yeah,
and very popular. Reprinted quite a lot.
Wow. Where
they bury Joe Shelby's flag in the Rio Grande, and it's very sing-song lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as we're saying, a couple years have to pass before Alonzo feels comfortable enough to return to the United States. He's also bribed by his mother to, like, come back and be with his wife and child. But he's very distrustful of he still doesn't want to take the ironclad oath and that kind of thing. Will call himself a Confederate until his dying day.
Right. And then his brother, meanwhile, they make a good team because they both bring totally different but valuable skills to what will eventually create the Veiled Prophet. But his brother Charles makes his name or makes money or his mark in New Orleans, right?
As a financier. He's climbing the ranks of the moneyed elite in New Orleans while Alonzo is away, and that involves a lot of joining various clubs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the post-war era, we then go through this big, you know, reasserting of the plantation violence through various organizations, the democratic clubs, which are famously not very democratic and, in fact, quite brutal in New Orleans, or the Knights of the White Camellia, which were for more of the ritzy New Orleans elite, but also through these Mardi Gras carnival crews, like the Mystic Crew of Comus, and then you have Protus, and then Rex. These are all sort of carnival crews of rich guys in a secret club who put on a parade during Mardi Gras. And they have characters, including Lalla Rookh, which the second poem in that book of poetry by Thomas More is called The Veiled Prophet of Khorasan. And I think that is exactly where Charles and Alonzo, at some point after Alonzo has come back, they are both involved with the Mystic Crew of Comus, and they see in New Orleans a float of, the Veiled Prophet. Mm. And it's hard to ignore that, there's also that thing, the Ku Klux Klan, that is happening and has become a newspaper sensation. And that guy kind of looks like some of those guys.
Mm-hmm. Right. So these floats, which the Alonzo brothers would take to be, and the kind of societies behind some of these floats, that the Alonzo brothers would later use as inspiration for what they were going to create in St. Louis.
Yeah.
The Mardi Gras itself is a much, much more actually kind of more democratic bacchanalia or festival, right? Or is it, has it been transformed, or is it partly kind of a way of elites, or maybe after the war, the elites imposing their power over the rest? Or how would, because it's not the same in the Mardi Gras and these floats as it would become with the Veiled Prophet, which was a lot more menacing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is the central contradiction of both Comus and Rex and the Veiled Prophet, is that I tend to agree with Bakhtin in Rabelais and His World, where he argues that, you know, in the medieval ages, the Mardi Gras is the release valve of all the pressure of the pent-up church dictum rules and the monarchy and the sort of rigid but invisible structures that keep everybody doing what they have to do and subjugated and mercilessly. sort of put to work. And then you have this big eruption of farting and burping and feasting and fucking. And there's like a big outlet for all these human libidinal urges that like tears the mask away from the king and sort of makes the priest into an ass and turns a nun into a prostitute. And that like that is a very healthy thing that mm-hmm. has to be done in such a repressive society. Mm-hmm. And that these crews and these secret societies of rich guys basically pay, because the big thing that they do is that they have the money to buy frivolous parade floats.
Right.
You know,
right.
There's like sort of nothing more wasteful than paying a whole bunch of money for a thing that will be wheeled through the streets for one night.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it's a big display of wealth, and it sort of was like, oh, well, now we control this anarchy also.
Right.
Which worked out well in New Orleans, and it was mirrored again in St. Louis, but in order to crush a railroad strike.
Right.
Or yeah. celebrate the crushing of one.
Right. So I'm going to ask you real quickly what, as we're going to get into actually the creation of the circumstances and the, you know, creation of the Veiled Prophet and all this, what interested you in this? I mean, did you grow up, was the Veiled Prophet Festival, whatever you'd call it, was it a big deal when you were growing up in St. Louis? Or is it something you always kind of wondered about? Or was it kind of later you started thinking, what the hell is this thing? Or like, how did it become a subject for you of a book? And you know, when you get into anything like these kind of weird conspiratorial secret societies, you know, you're gonna go down halls of mirrors and rabbit holes mm-hmm. aplenty. But how did you get interested in this?
Yeah, I was born in 1990, and the VP Fair sort of changed over in the early 2000s. But I do remember it became Fair St. Louis because of the big PR catastrophe with the Veiled Prophet. Mm-hmm. But I remember going down to the Arch where they would have the McDonnell Douglas-sponsored air show, and they mm-hmm. would have the Harrier that would hover over the Mississippi River mm-hmm. and just be cacophonously loud, just like ear-shatteringly, like,
yeah,
like almost a panic. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, people used to take that seriously until they didn't.
Yeah. Right.
It had its moments in the Argentine War.
Yes.
And it showed off in a few, I don't know, James Bond movies or something. But then they thought...
Yes, exactly. Huh.
I mean, I got to admit, I loved the Harrier as a kid because it was like a real version of Thunderbirds, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
Yes.
A jet that takes off vertically. Like it was, yeah.
Right. Or an X-wing fighter. It's
that's
pretty cool. If only it couldn't be heard from like 17 counties away.
Yes, yes.
And so I was into, I also am really interested in Thomas Pynchon and mm-hmm. his works of historical fiction. And I was going to grad school after working some pretty awful jobs. And around St. Louis and sort of getting a little taste of, I mean, growing up, there's a conservatism in St. Louis that is like unique because we're secretly a Southern city that also is labeled by the South as a Northerner city. Mm-hmm. And so we're like in the center of too much stuff, and it has created an elite class, and especially a like business owner men's class that is very uniquely stodgy and backwards. And I was trying to write like a Pynchon-esque novel about St. Louis history to sort of talk about that. And my mom had mentioned this creepy parade that she remembered. Mm. She had, in the 70s, she grew up in the projects in St. Mm. Louis. And so she had like a tough childhood. But she remembers the the Veiled Prophet character coming through town and throwing candy to everybody, and how that was like such a strange but interesting guy. And then, of course, I found out that Jonathan Franzen beat me to that novel by like 10 years, because his first one, The 27th City, is a Pynchon-esque novel about St. Louis. So
is it?
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's even got, it focuses on, he's got the Probst family, who are modeled on the Anheuser-Busch dynasty, and they, in one scene, one of the patriarch of that family is the Veiled Prophet, and he's late to go to the ball, and he has to check his car at the Chase Park Plaza, and he says, "Get out of my way, I'm the Veiled Prophet." And
I see. Well, we're not
nice
huge.
You could use that line, like, yeah, I know. My way.
Yeah.
Also, nobody would know. I mean, I could just go there and say, "I'm the Veiled Prophet. Take me in."
Exactly. Yeah. Let me in. Give me a suite. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the original starting point. And then I found that this is such a rich labor history nonfiction story that you gotta do it right.
I mean, that's one aspect that really impressed me about your book. The number of times that, even if it was an empty promise, black laborers stood up toward a white union crowd and said, "Will you support us?" And the crowd said back, "Yes, yes, absolutely."
Yeah. Sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it ultimately becomes the crack that splits that strike is a racial disagreement against Albert Curlin. But that is like one of the most beautiful. I mean, St. Louis is a city with a history that is not very bright and not very, it's sometimes very difficult to look directly at because of what it implies, but then there are these little moments of like, I think, beauty that you really have to latch on to, and that's definitely one of them. As is the history of the worker organizing in the 1930s, where United Electric has a rival Veiled Prophet ball, and they go up against, Emerson Electric to organize the big three and William Centner and all these guys.
Yeah, the UE is amazing. I got to know some of them out in D.C., actually. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, and through Mike Elk, who's a reporter. His dad was a big organizer in the UE at General Electric Plants. And they have the UE put out an amazing book about labor. It's called Labor's Untold Story, and it's really about insurgency and counterinsurgency in the labor wars, and it's really a powerful book. Which brings us, I think, to the let's get back to the creation of the Veiled Prophet, which revolves around one of the first really major industrial strikes in the U.S.
Yeah, this is the 1877 Great Railroad Strike, which historians really need to, like, we got to title it something more exciting than that next time. But this is a railroad strike that starts in, New York, Pennsylvania, Baltimore, and shoots west down the rails all the way to the edge of the country, which terminates in St. Louis at this moment still in 1877. Alonzo Slayback is back in St. Louis. He's around for this, but the depression, the Long Depression, as they called it, culminates in just massive immiseration in all American cities and wages that are being cut and cut and cut, even as the railroad industry booms, as Jay Gould gets richer and richer, doing railroad speculation and building all of this stuff, and eventually, in July of 1877, we're coming up on the anniversary of it. Strikes break out across the country. The National Guard is pulled in all directions. This is also the year where a lot of historians mark as the end of Reconstruction, because Union troops that had been occupying the South get called to these cities during the strike to put down the rabble. And it's like, okay, that's the end of Reconstruction and the beginning of the Gilded Age, or right, whatever we want to call it.
Yeah.
And so in St. Louis, what's also very unique is that this is a multiracial strike. There's a ton of black labor that is on the riverfront, roustabouts who bring stuff on and on, off and on steamships.
Sounded to me from your account like they had the worst lives of all.
Mm. Oh, terrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like walking a gangplank with a giant barrel on your back, like all day long, over and over, overseen by, you know, white managers. There's a very good communist painter from the 30s named Joe Jones in St. Louis, and he has a really... he's depicted these in many paintings, and there's one that's called Roustabouts, and it's the white boss looking at a bunch of very downtrodden black laborers on the riverfront. It's very powerful. It is the worst job, and it's the, as these things always go, it's the first job that's abandoned by white labor that then gets picked up by African Americans, and they, you know, go from steamship to steamship, joining the strike of both the railroad starts it off, but then by the sort of third day of the strike, everybody, the coopers go on strike, the newsboys do, the bellhop at the hotel does. It's like it turns into a general strike in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. Was it a general strike elsewhere too, or was St. Louis unique in that way, or do you know?
I think that St. Louis was pretty unique in that, but there were coalitions with other industries in, like, Chicago, I believe.
Right.
This is, like, where the Battle of the Viaduct happened and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it was – in St. Louis, it was all of the industry went on strike and the whole city shut down for a week.
Right.
In order to negotiate between the railroad executives and the executive committee for a week, they were able to hold it. And Eric Foner's uncle, Philip Foner, he wrote a very good book about this, in which St. Louis is the cornerstone or the ending capstone, because the I think it's the Bleacher sugar refinery has to ask the executive committee for permission to keep producing sugar, and that officially
has to
makes
ask the workers'
committee.
Executive committee, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yes. It has to ask them for permission to keep refining, and that by default makes them the governing body,
right,
which inaugurates the St. Louis Commune.
Right. And I mean, you point out also that what was on a lot of people's mind was the Paris Commune from just a few years earlier. It was very much on the business leaders and the elite's mind in a terrified way, and everyone else's. And as you say, they created an alternative, basically government that had real power, an alternative government in St. Louis for that week. And you know, the fear that must have put into the fear, the horror that must have put in the people who are used to being at the top of the hierarchy. I mean, it's as threatening as anything to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were filling their bathtubs with water because they were convinced that the workers would shut off water to the mansion districts. They were fleeing the city for their countryside estates. There's a very real, like, panic that, you know, yeah, as you say, the Paris Commune is like in everybody's minds, and that St. Louis could go and then there could be a domino effect throughout the Midwest, because this could happen in Milwaukee and Chicago and like Pittsburgh, and suddenly that would be a big problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's worth remembering at the moment that, you know, red states aren't forever, any more than blue states. I mean,
exactly.
As Yeats said, that this fat, pragmatical pig of the world, its pharaoh that so solid seemed, must vanish in an instant if the mind but changes theme.
Yeah.
I mean, the commune even, I mean, what came to a head at the end was, should the workers go and liberate the arsenal that was liberated during by the Germans? Should we run the Civil War back and see if, like, we should arm all the workers to fend off the National Guards and the Gatling guns that are on their way from Fort Leavenworth?
Right.
And ultimately, there was a crisis, and the executive committee balked, and then they got run out of town. Schuyler's Hall is where they got broken up officially.
Right. And so then now we're going to get to this secret society, the Veiled Prophet, which, you know, you do a great job of trying to explain why powerful people create secret societies, what functions they serve, and how their displays and their, you know, deliberate sort of mysticisms and all this, how they work. Because it is, you know, reading this, one of my reactions reading this was, because I never joined any fraternity or any secret society, was, I guess I was a chump. You know, I don't know. But I found these things to be just ridiculous. But this is where power is organized. And, you know, these rituals just seem so silly and absurd. But power is organized around them. And it got me thinking of William Grider's Great History of the Federal Reserve, Secrets of the Temple. And a lot of what he writes about is the ceremony and the deliberate kind of religious mysticism around the Federal Reserve, around the creation of money, around the creation of interest rates. And even like on the dollar bills, of course, you know, we have these, or in coins, you know, we have these Masonic symbols, because power is a weird thing. It's enforced to, you know, in the hardest level at gunpoint, but that's not an efficient way to enforce power. And mystery is a way to, mystery and conspiracy are ways of kind of enforcing power, both by organizing the rich and powerful, but also by kind of dazzling the rest of us.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember the Bohemian Grove.
Like, yes, yes.
I was an undergraduate at Berkeley, and I thought of those things as ridiculous.
Yes.
But at the same time, for all the reasons you say, Mark, they were not ridiculous.
Yeah.
And they endured a lot longer than the customs of Berkeley did.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of like they could say to us, if you're so not ridiculous, why ain't you rich? You know? So but anyway, yeah. So, go ahead.
I mean, the uniting theme is like theater, and how like the theater of power, and how it is like, you become a character, and you even, I think, are trying to touch this deific feeling of omniscience. And like, by printing money at the Federal Reserve, they're like bringing light into a dark world, you know? Mm-hmm. And that is very much what the Veiled Prophet stuff is about. That's what I think. I mean, there's also just the basic human thing of, if something is occluded or if something is secret, it automatically becomes a black hole, a void that you want to find as much like information about along the rim as you can to try to see what's at the center.
Right.
I just had a side question. Was there any rivalry between the Mardi Gras and the Veiled Prophets of St. Louis, or were they acting more or less for the same reasons?
Oh, that's a great question. I think they were mostly doing the same play. There's the purpose of like the parade eventually became, at first it was to, you know, remind all of these workers of what their place is. And so the Veiled Prophet in the first parade appears with an an executioner and a bloody butcher's block. And we know the first Veiled Prophet because they announce him in the newspaper as the chief of police, John Priest. So, not very subtle message.
No, even to the name.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right. These are all pinch-on names. Slayback, Priest, yeah, it's crazy. Lion, come on now. Yeah. He's brave. But then the purpose of the Veiled Prophet celebration becomes to draw when farmers are bringing their yield in from the hinterlands, they have to come to St. Louis to sell it. And then they've got a big fat stack of cash in their hand. And there's got to be a big party in order to deprive that, bumpkin of his bills. And so the Veiled Prophet starts with the agricultural and mechanical fair. And that's like kind of the draw is to come in for this celebration, which is also how it works, I think, in New Orleans for Mardi Gras is to, there's sort of these regional vacuums to bring in money from the agricultural sector. And then in Kansas City, it was so successful that they invented their own Veiled Prophet guy named King Kiki. KKK, not very subtle either.
Yeah.
But also that these characters serve the purpose of letting everybody know that when you come into the city, you're coming into a white supremacist zone and that you're not going to be troubled by African-Americans or anything like that because we're worshiping a Klansman here.
Right. The Veiled Prophet, the image of the first Veiled Prophet, I mean, it's pretty menacing, especially as it comes as, well, I guess the KKK has already been officially outlawed, but it's very strong in the memory of the underclass and of African Americans for sure.
Yeah, traumatic and required an enormous amount of federal intervention in order to destroy by the Grant administration.
Right.
Making it illegal to cover your face on the highways. But you can slip through the KKK acts if you put a little poetic dressing on this, parade character that you have. And it's not a Klansman. He's a Thomas More character.
Right.
Let alone that Moore character is a villain and is like a bad guy who we don't want to emulate, you would think. But
right.
That's another really interesting episode that you describe. There are two very intrepid female heroines, I guess. And one of them rappels down a building and the other one snatches the hat off the Grand Klansman or whatever.
Right. We're fast forwarding to that. That's an amazing moment though. But yeah.
I think that is like the pinnacle of the story because that is in the poem. Zelica is the sort of damsel who gets entranced by the Veiled Prophet.
Right.
And she wants to know what's under the veil. And then he shows it to her and it basically like wipes her brain away. But in the 60s, when the civil rights movement is kicking off in St. Louis, Jenna Scott is sort of the heroine of the story because, as John said, she grabs an electrical cord and rappels down in the middle of the big Veiled Prophet ceremony with all of the executives from Anheuser-Busch and McDonnell Douglas and Monsanto and the Post-Dispatch editorial board and the Globe Democrat. They're all there, and she like sneaks up and is like, oh, I got to get a phone call, and then appears on the stage and unveils Tom K. Smith, the vice president of Monsanto at the height of the Agent Orange productive cycle for them. Which,
I mean, he's bald. believe me, would be worse.
And his toupee comes off with the veil, and it's very embarrassing.
She's like a literal Spider Woman. She rappels down this long electrical cord like a spider. I just imagine it, and comes crashing the floor, but she's fine. And she's fine, and that the worry about her maybe being injured gives her, she's such sharp thinking, gives her that kind of opening to be able to stay on stage and rip the veil off. It was it's an amazing moment.
Yeah, it's a whole orchestrated thing with, you know, there's two other people who had gotten tickets, female action protesters mm-hmm. who are throwing leaflets from the balcony and distracting everybody. And of course, there's also Percy Green, who is the organizer. Mm-hmm. He is the equivalent of the Martin Luther King of St. Louis, except he also had a flair for the theatrical, mm-hmm. you know, guerrilla protest. And so Jenna Scott rips the veil off. She gets dragged away. Later, her apartment gets broken into and her car gets firebombed. There's like a retaliation against her. But that's like the apex of the club. And from then on out, it's all downhill.
By the way, McDonnell Douglas, maker of the F-4 Phantom, which was recently used by Iran to bomb American bases.
Oh, talk about irony. Douglas.
Yeah, irony there.
Yeah, because this is really fast forwarding, but they get into a bunch of trouble, McDonnell Douglas, for selling jets to the Saudi government and getting involved with the BCCI banking scandal. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're sort of on the tail end of the Lockheed scandal as well, when they sold planes to Pakistan, right? Is that right? And, or is that all part of the Saudi deal?
I think that sounds about right. There's a few different of those happening at the same time.
Right. Exactly. Because the Lockheed scandal, I've written about it, was about, well, the CIA was embedded in Lockheed, and Lockheed wanted contracts. The CIA wanted to run politics. So the CIA would pass bribe money to Lockheed executives who would give it to like Japanese or Dutch or whatever, political power brokers. And in return, they would get pro-American policies, and they would buy sometimes really shitty Lockheed planes. And so from that, I mean, I was surprised to see that McDonnell Douglas executives were even charged, but that was kind of the vibe at the very end of the 70s in that brief kind of perestroika era, glasnost era that the U.S. had. So we're skipping over so much because, well, you got to read the book. You got to get the book. I mean, let's not say what happens to Alonzo Slayback, but his final moment is just amazing, and we'll save that for people who get the book, and we want to leave a few cliffhangers here.
It's a true episode, yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's great. You know, that's why I think, in a sense, you didn't need to make fiction, because the nonfiction is so wild and takes you into so many corners and so many stories. But you have, as I said, you've divided it into kind of three eras. The second era is 1883 to 1972. That's really like the period where the Veiled Prophet becomes this integral part of the St. Louis elites. There's a lot of labor history in there trying to track, because labor, you know, that's the war that we don't talk a lot about, at least in kind of official America, but that's labor's war and labor's struggles against the ruling classes is a constant. And you do a really good job again through this thread of talking about or writing about St. Louis's decline, which is a story of so many cities between the coasts. I'm living outside of Rochester, and this is another, like, I could see a lot of this, of what you're writing about here. Different particulars, but some of the same larger forces and dynamics in a big way. By the way, I just want to mention, there's a really fascinating kind of angle here through the Veiled Prophets and the story we just talked about, which gets into the Martin Luther King assassination and the conspiracy about it, which is really because, of course, James Earl Ray was from Missouri, and he escaped from the prison in Missouri, and the House committee actually investigated a St. Louis trail in a potential conspiracy. They eventually ruled that James Earl Ray did fire the gun, but that there was a conspiracy and they were never able to figure it out, right?
Yeah, there's a whole sort of, in the constellation of theories from the HSCA, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, it's like the St. Louis vein all comes down to the reincarnation of Alonzo Slayback in a man named John Sutherland, who's another lawyer in St. Louis who worked for the Olin ammunition people, of course, as well as, I believe, he had some defense contracts. But he, it is alleged by a few people that Sutherland invited a guy to his house and showed up at the door with a Confederate hat on, one of the gray hats. And then there's just stars and bars everywhere and Confederate paraphernalia in his living room. And he offered this guy a pretty robust sum of money to kill Martin Luther King. And that is like a thing that would have been substantiated because Sutherland was always trying to get George Wallace to come to St. Louis. He was inviting, I forgot the name of the sheriff from Mississippi that he had up, who was the big famous racist, the Joe Arpaio of that day. And that he was also in charge of the White Citizens Council, which also gets sort of neglected in our stories about the 60s and 70s is how much the sort of George Wallace White Citizens Committees like formed this semi-fascist anti-civil rights movement. It was very popular in southern South St. Louis City around the Grapevine Tavern, which is where it is alleged that James Earl Ray was offered the same deal by John Sutherland. But there's not a lot of, I mean, there's more documents that are supposed to come out next year to be unsealed, but there's no smoking gun necessarily, but there's a lot of smoke.
As you and even like when John and I have talked to us in the past, there were a lot of contracts going around at that time to kill from people like Sutherland, if it wasn't Sutherland himself, for somebody to kill Martin Luther King Jr., you know. But the Sutherland Trail, I thought it was a really interesting story. I mean, I feel like the conspiracy theory crowd doesn't really spend enough time on the Martin Luther King assassination, which is like, I mean, those are some rabbit holes. It's just wild, that story and all the, you know, the strange things that went on with that. And
It gets forgotten how, I mean, the Poor People's Campaign was going to encamp thousands of civil rights protesters in the National Mall, akin to what was the Veterans Campaign in the 30s?
Oh, the Bonus
March. The Bonus March.
Yeah.
They were going to do the Bonus March playbook in order to like lobby Congress constantly at the same level that, you know, all the paid industry in this country gets to. That was going to be an active threat to the daily life of all of these senators. And King was, of course, also railing against Vietnam and also seeing the future of the civil rights movement as a worker movement. These are all very dangerous.
The poor man's march.
Things.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes,
it was one thing giving them the right to vote. That doesn't cost anything necessarily, certainly to the North. Another thing to redistribute wealth and wind down the empire. That was a different story. So at the end, you get to the story of, well, the Veiled Prophet and Ferguson and Black Lives Matter, which really emanates out of basically Greater St. Louis. I mean, who can forget the images of that couple, the Patricia and Mark McCloskey, with their guns in their lawn on their private street? Yeah, I wrote about that some years ago for Pando, about how St. Louis had actual privatized streets, which were hailed as like, you know, true freedom by libertarian groups like Reason Foundation and stuff like that. Like, this is what we want America to become: privatized streets where everybody's armed and everybody's, you know, it's everybody against the rich against everybody.
The streets, of course, are hooked up to the St. Louis grid and the sewer system, and they're policed by the St. Louis police. Yes. And the St. Louis Fire Department has to show up if anything catches fire. But sure, they're libertarian paradises,
right?
And not a tick, a parasite on the rest of the city. Right. Yeah, Mark and Patricia are on the Palazzo steps with their AR-15, which was a Bush family. It was supposed to be the crown jewel of the Anheuser-Busch dynasty. But yeah, they are. They became famous in that era, as did Ferguson, which is where Emerson Electric has its gigantic headquarters. Mm. In a municipality that, as we learned later, after, you know, the military and the national news and also the three percenters showed up and pointed guns at all of these people, that Ferguson is just an extraction machine through ticketing and over policing and a, you know, a active pipeline from the schools to prisons. Just a, you know, a totally, I don't know, just an evil machine built by neoliberalism that, of course, required blood in order for enough people to turn their attention to it.
Yeah,
sucks.
Very depressing.
And still hasn't really gotten better.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just to tell people again, there's a lot in this book. I mean, characters like Thomas Dooley, Dr. America. There's a link to the Veiled Prophet in St. Louis there. Clark Clifford, who is, he's like, he's both like a pretty boy and the super operator. I don't even know what to make of him, but I know from having researched so many stories that are basically, you know, the creation of the American Empire, national security state, and going through, you know, through decades, he's such a weird central figure. And God, even that traces back to the Veiled Prophet in St. Louis. You know, Olin Foundation, man, when I used to research and write a lot about the right and the development of right-wing power in this country, Olin was such a big part of that. Still is.
Oh, really?
For that matter. Yeah, the Olin Foundation has funded so much kind of right-wing and neoliberal, you know, think tankery and like economic seats and lost professor seats in Ivy League schools and so on. It's from a weapons manufacturer and gunpowder and all that stuff, yeah.
It like starts with selling bullets to people who are going to go out west, and then ramps up steadily with every war, the Spanish-American, World War I, II. And then eventually you get the Washington University Business School named after John Olin.
Right. Huh. Yeah, so this is a great book.
It's a really great book.
Like, there's a lot
in
there.
I'm so happy you liked it.
Very meaty, very rich. You know, a lot of times, like, You know, so things that you've known or seen, you get to see them again from a different angle and make sense of them, you know, persons or events in the last sort of 200 years. Congratulations again, anyway, Devin. And thanks for coming on Radio Warner, too. Great book.
Thank you very much.
It's a tremendous honor. You both are like, you know, the senior gods in my pantheon of left writing and history work. And it really is such a honor to that you liked the book and found it interesting and fun to read.
Oh, yeah.
Like, absolutely.
I can't ask for more, honestly.
Oh, cool. That's thanks so much. I appreciate it. Thank you to Devin Thomas O'Shea, the author of, and we'll post links, The Veiled Prophet, Secret Societies, White Supremacy, and the Struggle for St. Louis. It's coming out June 23rd, but pre-order now through Haymarket Books. Anyways, thanks, Devin. Thanks, John and Brendan and all of our subscribers. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.